طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we present a forum held at the Friends Meeting House in Cambridge that features responses to a unique graphic installation developed by Dr. Stephen Feldman, who was brought up in a strict Jewish family and community, who now, through his installation, challenges us to exercise Jewish values in an examination of the occupation of Palestine by Israel. The Jewish Museum of the Palestinian Experience was founded to provide a Jewish perspective on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Although Steve Feldman lives in North Carolina, he ships this installation at his own expense anywhere that will host it. Basically, Dr. Feldman is urging us all to measure our attitudes and actions according to the prophet Jeremiah, rather than the politician Benjamin Netanyahu. This forum begins with a Friends national prominent leader, Max Carter, followed by local Palestinian activist Nancy Murray, and concludes with Steve Feldman, creator of the Promised Land exhibit. Following the presentations, the floor is opened up for discussion, and we have included as much of that as time would allow.
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here, and one of the tangential delights of this is seeing old friends from Earlham days and Guilford days and various pasts of my life. But thank you all for being here. My first awareness of the Middle East, having grown up in the Midwest on a Quaker dairy farm in Indiana, was the 67 war. And typical of most folk in my community, this was seen in kind of evangelical terms, that this was God's having created this miracle of Israel's being able to defeat these surrounding Arab armies in just 6 days. And that was the context in which that was described. I became a conscious objector, as I shared this morning with the forum, after hearing a Hiroshima maiden share about what it was like August 6th, 1945, and her description of the horrors of that led me to the convincement that I cannot participate in systems that made that kind of horror possible. But my world was pretty restricted. If any of you grew up on a dairy farm, you never get more than 15 miles away because you got to turn around and milk cows that night. So I had a very provincial understanding. But as a conscious objector, I was given the opportunity in 1970 to do my alternative service, and I chose to do that in Ramallah because I grew up hearing stories of my great aunt Annis Carter, who had taught at the Quaker schools in Ramallah beginning in 1929 for many years over a period of 50 years. And I wanted to do my alternative service teaching. That was my undergraduate work in a war zone, and Ramallah qualified. But let me give you a little bit of the history of how Quakers got to Ramallah. It was in 1868 when two New England Quakers, Eli and Sybil Jones, Rufus Jones's aunt and uncle, you know, we pause now for Quakers to do homage to the Saint Rufus Jones. And they were attending an educational conference in Jerusalem. and went up to the little dusty village of Ramallah, a Christian town established in the 1500s, and met there a 14-year-old girl who had had some limited education at a Catholic school in Jerusalem and wanted more education. And who better to ask to start a school than two Quakers? And Eli and Sybil Jones said, well, who would teach in this school? And the little Karam girl said, I would. And Eli and Sybil Jones went back to the States, raised funds, and in 1869, the Friends Girls School opened, eventually in 35 villages there, during the Ottoman Turkish rule. So again, Quaker chutzpah, go to the Ottoman Turks and open up a school for girls. And in 1901, a school for boys was established. Now, the first Quaker work then, of course, was educational, and it was out of the more evangelical branch of Friends. So it was kind of that missionary model. Later on, of course, American Friends Service Committee came in. AFSC still has an office in Jerusalem, working both in Israel and in the Palestinian territories on a variety of issues. But I want to give another New England connection, because I think it applies to what we all hope we're doing there, beating swords into plowshares in a way. Timothy and Anna Hussey were very significant in the development of the Quaker work there in Ramallah. How many of you know the Hussey Seating Company in North Berwick, Maine? They now make stadium seating all over the world. They started off as Hussey Plow Company. Timothy Hussey was the president of this company that had innovated in the moldboard plow in the mid-1800s, revolutionizing agriculture. As a good Quaker, after the Civil War, he bought up hundreds of surplus Union cannons, melted them down, and made plows out of them. With exception of one, he was such a good Quaker pacifist that he welded shut the wick holes so that nobody could steal one away and use it for war. But his half-brother, William Penn Hussey, snuck one off, and the following July the 4th, set that sucker off and broke every pane of glass in North Berwick, Maine, and Timothy Hussey had to pay for them all. But when he retired, he went to Ramallah, and with his expertise in business and with his financial backing, he bought the land and supervised the construction of the buildings for the girls' school, the boys' school, and the Quaker meeting house. So there's a wonderful New England connection to that work. My wife and I now go each year to take groups over to Israel and Palestine, volunteer at the Quaker schools with just simple work, painting, cleaning, landscaping, and introduce people to the complexities of it. As I shared this morning, you can come back and talk till your face is blue about the realities there, but no one will believe you because their facts are alternative to your facts. And we found the most effective thing is to simply take people there and let them experience it and see it for themselves on both sides and the many sides, right to left on either side. Fatah to Hamas in Palestinian territory, settlers and kibbutzniks to Breaking the Silence and Rabbis for Human Rights on the other side. And often we're the couriers across this 27-foot-high concrete wall or electrified fence to communicate, because it's hard for us to understand that people who live next door to each other don't know each other because there's so many barriers. And so part of what we try to do is communicate across those barriers of what people on the other side are doing. And quite often it comes as a surprise that we have peace partners there. We have people we can work with. And the other important part of it is accompanying the people who are really doing the work. We're there for 2.5 weeks each summer, but there are people there who are literally in the trenches day in and day out, Palestinians and Israelis doing that hard work and accompanying and encouraging the Soldiers in Breaking the Silence, Rabbis for Human Rights, the Israeli Committee for Home Against Home and Demolitions, the Nasser family were trying to hold on to their farm surrounded by four settlements, the Al-Rawad Center in Bethlehem, where they're teaching beautiful resistance through dance and theater and photography, that we don't want you to die for your country, we want you to live for your country, and support the people doing that work.
Good afternoon, everybody. In November of last year, I led an eyewitness Palestine delegation to the West Bank in Israel. I've done almost 20 trips since my first visit in 1988 during the First Intifada. This one was particularly depressing for a number of reasons that I don't have time to go into here. But suffice it to say that I returned to the United States thinking there was little to be hopeful about. But I soon discovered how mistaken I was. And the reason for renewed hope is here in this room. Dr. Steven Feldman has created a remarkable exhibit. You've seen only a fraction of it standing up. The rest is on the website, and I urge you to really explore it, promisedlandmuseum.org. It brings together a wealth of important material, much of it historical documentation that challenges the one-sided narration that we have been fed, force-fed, for far too long. And let me just say a few words about what I think is so special. If you go to the website and look at the short film, which is in the introduction, it debunks many of the myths about Israel's founding and military occupation, stereotypes about Palestinians. And if you look at that, you can see just how courageous this is at such a time in the United States. Because this website does not pull its punches. It provides documentation and photos showing how Jews and Palestinians coexisted during the Ottoman period. Did you know that the everyday language of Jews in Jerusalem in the 19th century was Arabic? It highlights original source material to show that Palestine and Palestinians did indeed exist. You remember we were told at one point they didn't. And that Zionists considered their movement to be a colonialist project. Some of this you see on these big panels, but to go to the website, you will get much more information about this, including much more information about the terrorist attacks carried out by the Stern Gang and Irgun. It does not shirk from showing the brutality of Israel's occupation in the West Bank and the impact of repeated military offenses against the people of the Gaza Strip. And it raises up the voices of courageous Israelis like Ilan Pappe, Gideon Levy, Miko Peled, and Iran Efrati, and those of American Jews telling their stories of wrestling with Zionism. It even brings in a comparison with apartheid South Africa and includes BDS in a section describing Palestinian peaceful protest. Putting all of this in one resource, a resource which is really aimed at getting Jewish community to see another side of this story, I think is quite an achievement. I want to focus now on two matters which I hope can be included at a future date. First, as a member of the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, I recommend linking to the Paris Peace Conference documents, the documents that were submitted to make the case for a national home in Palestine for the Zionists, for Israel. One of these resolution states, quote, "The economic life of Palestine, like that of every other semi-arid country, depends on the available water supply. It is therefore of vital importance not only to secure all water resources already feeding the country, but to be able to conserve and control them at their sources." And there's a map that the Zionist movement submitted, which shows the borders of their desired state state stretching far across the Litani River, deep into present-day Lebanon, Syria's Golan Heights, and across the Jordan River. Now, you've seen here that there is material in this exhibit about water. There's an informative section on how Israel has deprived Palestinians of water in both the West Bank and Gaza Strip on the website. But I would say that including this earlier historical material, especially the map, will illustrate how controlling the West Bank and coastal aquifers, the Jordan River and its headwaters in neighboring countries, was part of the Zionist project from its inception. And second, there is the critical matter of the Gaza Strip, which I was last able to enter in 2016. The Promised Land website certainly does not ignore Gaza. It contains visual and written references to the destruction Israel has meted out in its military offenses. It touches on the lethal water situation in Gaza, where 98% of the water is unfit to drink, and it has a link to the film Gaza Surf Club. However, given the extent to which the people of Gaza and Hamas have been hyper-demonized, given the fact that the UN has reported that the Gaza Strip will be unlivable by 2020, given the physically and mentally devastating conditions of siege imposed on the Strip for the past 11 years, and given the case made by the Israeli historian Ilan Pappe in his book, The World's Biggest Prison, that what is going on in the Gaza Strip is, quote, incremental genocide, end quote, I think a more comprehensive focus on Gaza could fill a woeful informational vacuum. Because how many Americans today are aware that 70% of the population of 2 million people who are caged in the tiny Gaza Strip are refugees living in 8 refugee camps, most of them descendants of the 250,000 Palestinians who fled to Gaza during the Nakba? Before the Nakba, there were only 80,000 people living in the district of Gaza, which was known for its rich agricultural land. Now the Gaza Strip is deeply impoverished and one of the most densely crowded places on earth. And many of the refugees confined within its walls and high fences and guard towers that surround it are living only miles from their former homes in Israel. How many Americans know that since 2008, Israel has conducted 5 major military offenses against Gaza, killing thousands, more than 800 of them children, destroying the infrastructure, homes, and so on? You might have seen that on the news, but did you know that afterwards, Israel refused to lift its siege, keeping out essential building materials, forcing people to live amid raw sewage and in the rubble of their homes? And how many know that Israel is continuing with its snipers to kill and injure Palestinians in what began a year ago on March 30th as a nonviolent uprising of the civil society known as the Great March of Return? Nearly 300 Palestinians have been killed since then, 45 of them children, and 30,000 injured in those protests. Now, I don't have time to go into those details, but it can be argued that the Gaza Strip is serving Israel as a kind of laboratory for field testing its new weapon systems and finding the breaking point of human beings. So I argue for more about Gaza in this website, this very valuable resource. And in terms of how you talk about Hamas, there are easy ways to do that. We have got voices, such as the voice of the chief of Mossad from 1998 to 2002, Ephraim Halevi, as long ago as 2010, calling for Israel to talk to Hamas. Many people have called for Israel to talk to Hamas. We have got wonderful resources here at Harvard, Sarah Roy, the child of Holocaust survivors, who's written widely about Hamas, showing that it's not just a terrorist organization, as it has been depicted. And there are many other other scholars whose works can be linked to. And you could also put a link to the revised Hamas charter, which, I don't know if you know, in 2017, they threw out their old charter, which was rightly called anti-Semitic. The new charter states, quote, Hamas does not wage a struggle against Jews because they are Jewish, but wages a struggle against Zionists who occupy Palestine. And that is a sentiment which I have heard there, which Medea Benjamin heard there when she went and talked to Hamas leaders. So this message and the pragmatic vision of Hamas's charter, unfortunately, have done nothing to end the isolation of the Gaza Strip, and now time is running out. Life in the ghetto that is Gaza Strip may not be comparable in all respects to the horrors of the Warsaw Ghetto, but its children, who make up half the population, are being stunted and poisoned as it slides into unlivability. And what is sorely needed, and what the Promised Land Museum can help to provide, is an urgent reminder that Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are human beings too. Thank you.
I'm Steve. I'm just your basic Jewish American dermatologist. All right? My area of special expertise is psoriasis. I don't know if you watch any television now. There's all these new drugs about psoriasis, and I give the best lectures in all of dermatology. People don't want to go on after I speak, just the same way I don't want to have to go on after Nancy speaks. Nancy, thank you for the homework assignments. I appreciate that. I grew up in an insular community, not exactly the same as Max. Mine was the Orthodox Jewish community of Washington, D.C. So I went to the Orthodox Hebrew school that my grandfather helped to found. Our class, I think there was something like 30 of us. So that was my world, these 30 kids. You know, I would go to other Orthodox synagogues besides my own for their bar mitzvahs. I would go to their birthday parties, but that was my whole world. I grew up in Washington, D.C., but as far as I was concerned, there were only two restaurants in town. Why? Because there were only two kosher restaurants in town. Exactly right. What did I know about Christians? Anybody know what I knew about Christians? No, I knew they killed Jews. That was the only thing I knew about Christianity. I didn't know about Jesus. I just knew Christians killed Jews. That was, you know, what my world was like. I can remember the 67 war, and we were attacked, and, you know, it was miraculous. And I can remember, you know, being at Hebrew school going, yeah, we Jews are much more caring than those Arabs, because we kill 20 of them for every one they kill of us. You know, and I believe stuff that they told me, like, Gold in My Ear said about Palestinian mothers not loving their children as much as they hate Jews. I mean, now I'm not so sure that isn't a quite racist notion along the lines of, if only black mothers love their children as much as they love watermelon. I mean, it's just absurd, some of the stuff that I believed growing up. So, like a lot of good Jewish kids, I went on to medical school. You know, my mom said she wasn't going to put any pressure on me. I could become any kind of doctor I wanted to be. And I became a dermatologist, mostly supposedly to do test tube research, but that career failed. And I started doing more health economics, health delivery research. And this put me, I actually studied how poorly patients use their medicine with computer chips in the caps of the medication containers that would record when patients open and close the bottles without telling patients that had those computer chips there. It was really fascinating research to find what people were really doing. And a lot of my work in medicine led me to believe that whenever anybody told me something bad about people in another group, don't believe it, you know? Like dermatologists, we tell each other, family doctors don't know what the hell they're doing, you know, because in my, you know, 20 years of experience taking care of thousands of patients that the family doctor sent over, I think I could count on one hand the number of times I saw a patient for rash that those jokers managed to clear up. Does anybody know why that is? Yeah, every time they make the right diagnosis and prescribe the right therapy and the patient gets well, they don't send me the patient. Yeah, but dermatologists look at their experience just the way, you know, if you're Jewish and you're wondering, well, what are Catholic priests like? Well, you read the newspapers, you know what Catholic priests are like, right? There's a bit of selection bias there. And so over and over again, you know, I'd hear people in my group telling me bad things. Oh, they tell me the insurers. The American Academy of Dermatology had a meeting, and they invited me to speak to insurers about the treatment of psoriasis. And the dermatologists thought these insurers didn't want to help patients. They just cared about the money. And, you know, I presented my information. They were very accepting of it. And at the break, one of the insurers comes to me and says, Steve, you know, you're being naive. The reason I can tell you're one of the good dermatologists, but the reason your buddies are using these new expensive medicines is because of the donuts that the drug companies bring. It's not because they care about their patients. It was fascinating. The insurers had this warped view of us the same way we had a warped view of them. And so now, with this understanding of the world as groups of people in different compartments all thinking ill of each other, I'm now visiting Israel with my wife's and my family, especially my wife's family. Her uncle is like the water minister of the country. So he's driving us around Israel, showing us all the places where water is important. It's like everywhere. And we're driving around and seeing all these places where they made the deserts bloom and where I had helped plant trees on the hills. And, you know, the thought occurred to me, 700,000 Palestinians became refugees in 48. Where were they living? You know, something's missing. I mean, they've shown me all of Israel. They haven't shown me any place where Palestinians had been living. And I thought, I must be missing something. So then I started pulling at this thread. And then I heard about a town, Deir Yassin, where we Jews had committed a massacre. And there's some argument about exactly what happened there, but nobody was proud of what was done. And I'm like, pull a little more. And then there's Safsaf, where we had raped people and looted. And I'm like, pull a little harder. And then there's like an Israeli Defense report, Israeli Defense Forces report that said the reason Palestinians left is because we kicked them out of their homes, left and right. There were war plans. The Israeli army's, the Jewish army's war plans actually called for expulsion of entire villages of people, destroying the villages and mining the debris. You know, this is in direct contradiction to what they told me growing up, which was that we had begged Palestinians to stay and that they had fled to make it easier to kill us Jews. Then I was reading this one a British woman who moved to Israel, and she decided to live in an Arab village and got along great with people. And she was the one who explained to me that Canada Park, I guess the Canadians had helped build this park, was built on the remains of Palestinian villages, and that those trees that, you know, I helped plant when I was a kid in Hebrew school in Israel were planted on the remains of Palestinian villages to hide the villages, to keep people from coming back. So, collecting all that information, I thought, I got to create a museum and make people aware of this. But then Max here says, well, Steve, you got to come with me and see, go to Palestine. Now, I'm an American Jewish doctor. Am I going to go into the West Bank with Max? I told him, let me look at my calendar. Nope, can't do it. So he asked me again. I'm like, look at my calendar, can't do it. And then he asked me again. I'm like, I got nothing on my calendar this year. My heart's saying, Steve, you're insane. They're going to kill you. And my brain is saying, no. There's going to be nice people there, just like everybody else. I'm going to tell you about my experience there very briefly. And I'll get to the point where the Palestinian was holding a knife at my neck. Just the one time. So I dermatology has been great to me. I get invited to go all over the world. I got to go to Iran a couple times, and I thought those were the Persian people, the friendliest people I have met anywhere, until Max took me to Palestine, to Ramallah, where we'd be walking down the street and people would invite us into their homes. You know, it was just as though these were like the people who were walking on the same stones that Jesus walked on. Well, they were. Now, there was the one time that, you know, here we are, this group of Quakers and folks, and I decided I'm going to go out on my own. You know, I'm going to trust that it's going to be okay, because everything in medicine has taught me people in other groups are fine. You're not going to have any problem going. Now, there were the big red signs as you enter the West Bank that says, do not enter, it's dangerous. And it's true, because I have high cholesterol and there's a lot of candy stores and ice cream and sweet shops. But I decided I'd go out on my own one night. I'm going to go out down. I'm on the streets of Palestine, Ramallah, all by myself, American Jewish doctor. I'm like, where should I go? And I'm like, where can I go and hear people talking and meet people? I'm like, I'm going to go to the barber shop. That's where people go to. And the guy had a knife, and he shaved my neck. And that was the one time the Palestinian had a knife in my neck.
Did anything occur while listening to your partners that you might want to hear more about?
Next time you meet
the show? I've only been to Ramallah once. Years before, as my uncle's driving around, he drove us through the West Bank, I don't know, a long time ago, and my wife's relatives are like, don't do that, it's dangerous, you know, you get killed. And they would put weapons with them in their car when they would drive places and stuff, and they were absolutely terrified. I believe that Southern whites in an earlier generation were absolutely terrified that blacks would rape their daughters and kill them and stuff in an earlier time when racism was prevalent. And I used to believe that these Southern whites, I live in North Carolina, I used to believe these Southern whites were these evil people with their separation system. Now I believe that they're just as nice and warm and friendly as all my Jewish relatives who are, you know, truly believe in peace and justice, but just have this misguided notion about what people in the other group are like, and that we could have peace tomorrow if we Jews would just say to Palestinian families, look, we made a big mistake kicking you out of your homes. We need to invite you back right now, and we'll rebuild the villages, and we'll put second stories on houses if there's a problem, and we'll create economic justice, which is critically important too, and I think causes the lingering issues that still appear, by making sure that every Palestinian village has some kind of factory or work, and that, you know, and if you know, I really don't think Palestinians would want to kick the Jews out and lose the high-tech industries, and I believe that the tourism industry of a peaceful, whatever you want to call it, Israel-Palestine, where 2 billion Christians want to come visit and 1.5 billion Muslims want to come visit, will create so much economic opportunity for everybody that it's a complete win-win, nobody loses solution to the problem.
If I could just add one thing. Salman Abu Sita, who's done all this work on maps, has demonstrated that, in fact, that could happen. Palestinians could be all invited back to their homes. There would be room, and it wouldn't displace, except maybe the person who's in your house, you know, they might have to be negotiated with. But in terms of space where the old villages are that are now under these trees, there's room.
And for those of you interested in this nascent tourism industry, the Palestinian Association for Cultural Exchange in Ramallah, Biri, is doing this through Adel Yahya's work. Just passed away a couple years ago, but his daughter, a graduate of the Ramallah Friends School, is heading that up now. They've done wonderful archaeological work, have restored a number of the historic buildings there, and there's a wonderful tourism industry needing your help.
Any other questions from the panelists? Then one question for each of you, maybe in turn, concerning support from or resistance from your core communities. So your Quaker meeting, Guilford College, your family, and maybe other organizations that you might be part of, and your synagogue or other Jewish communities. Because I suspect one reason it's very difficult for some of us to take any kind of public position or activism is that some of the folks who we rely on, in my case, the Quaker meeting, might say no.
Well, as I always told my students at Guilford in Quaker history, Quakers are a bit like tofu. They have some substance, but get their flavor from whatever they're stewing in at the time. And they're the large swath of the Quaker community where I come from, both in the Midwest and in the South, that's assimilated into the Protestant mainstream and don't look like you as a Quaker meeting in terms of worship and theology. And there's resistance in some of those swaths, surprisingly enough, given our history in that area, because of a theology of, well, you know, of revelation, that this land was given to a certain people by God, and that nothing's going to be resolved until Jesus returns. And there's this literal understanding of that theology that prevents openness to. Yeah, they will admit to the suffering of the other, but, you know, tough cookies, essentially, is their thought. I do have to say, in 2002, I was on an American Friends Service Committee study tour in the region. We went to one of the Israeli settlements deep in the heart of the West Bank, Karne Shimron, and we visited the offices of the Christian Friends of Jewish Communities organization. This is an organization that raises millions of dollars from evangelical Christians who have that theology. And all of this has to remain in order for Jesus to return. And one of the members of our delegation, Jim Matlack, some of you may know Jim Matlack, who's with the AFSC in Washington, D.C., he said, well, do you understand their theology? That when Jesus returns, there'll be the Battle of Armageddon, and all those who don't convert to Christianity will be slaughtered, including all Jews. And she laughed and said, oh, we understand that, but we can't be that choosy about who our friends are. And besides, she said, there's just a little in-joke among those of us in the settlement enterprise. When the Messiah comes, we'll just have one question. Is this your first or second visit?
That's funny. Yeah, I just went by Armageddon. It's Megiddo in Israel. I was fortunate in getting involved with Palestine when I worked at the American Civil Liberties Union, which I did for 25 years. And although many of the board members really didn't like what I was doing, what could they say about it? We believe in freedom of expression. And I'm glad to say that is really coming in useful now when there are all these attempts to pass anti-BDS legislation at the state level, at the federal level, and the ACLU has been wonderfully present fighting for the First Amendment in all those cases. So although I certainly know of the kind of pushback one gets, Alan Dershowitz and co. personally pushed me back, and tried to, you know, that kind of thing. Still, I think in terms of when I got involved, where there weren't a lot of groups that were active, not at all. You know, we were sort of in at the ground floor back in 1988. And the ACLU was, on the whole, pretty supportive.
If I want to know what a Christian Zionist believes, I don't go to Max to find out. Okay? I would like to have a Christian Zionist in the room tell me, you know. And he may be giving me an accurate perception of what their feelings are like. But you know, I've learned to assume the best about other people until proven otherwise. And I don't think I've ever been proven otherwise. That, you know, I just can't imagine these folks, whatever their theology, believe that it's okay, that their religion teaches them that it's okay for me to expel a peaceful non-Jewish family, particularly a peaceful Christian family, from their home. I mean, I just don't believe that anybody's religion teaches them that that's okay. And so, you know, if faced with someone who said, well, my theology is that this land was given to us Jews, to you Jews, I'd be like, so you're telling me that we Jews have a right, a responsibility to expel peaceful families, the mothers, the children, from their homes and make and keep them refugees from their homes. I just don't know that anybody believes that. Even we Jews, I mean, in Hebrew school, they didn't tell us you have a right to expel peaceful families from their homes. You know, the Jewish Voice for Peace just came out with something against Zionism, and more power to them, but I don't know that talking about Zionism is really that helpful, because the word means different things to different people. When we're growing up, and we have our Passover Seder, have y'all been to a Passover Seder? We pray next year in Jerusalem. We don't pray next year in Jerusalem by expelling peaceful non-Jewish families from their homes. We would not pray that. That just is not something we would ever even cross our minds. It's next year in Jerusalem. Yes, we would go there, but our goal is not to mistreat other people. The Holocaust did not teach us that it's okay to mistreat non-Jewish people. The Holocaust, if you go to the Holocaust Museum, you know it ends with the poem about first they came for the, well, they should have said first they came for the gays, then they came for the trade unions, they came for the Jews, then there was no one left, they came for me. You know, the whole point is you don't mistreat other people at all. Your question is, how do people in my community react to this? Yeah, my parents are not terribly happy with this, but this is, you know, even in the Jewish Voice for Peace community, I have trouble with my exhibit, because my exhibit consists exclusively of Jewish sources that explain how we expel Palestinian families from their homes. Now, if you're in Jewish Voice for Peace, you know that people should be listening to Palestinian voices, which, of course, they should, but they won't. And my parents certainly aren't going to. You say the word Nakba, my parents are going to turn off. They're not going to listen to the rest. So I just give them the Jewish side. And the Jewish side, the Jewish moral side, is that we kick people out of their homes, and that's against our morality.
Okay, thank you. Time for comments. Words from everybody.
Could you please say what BDS stands for?
Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And this is a call for nonviolent protest against Israel's occupation, against its discrimination within the state of Israel of non-Jews, and for the right of return. And it is a call that was issued by 171 civil society organizations within Palestine in the year 2005. And it has been gaining strength certainly around Europe, here as well, but in Europe, in some cases, it has real teeth. For instance, in Ireland, both houses of the Irish Parliament have now issued a call for a boycott of settlement products. And part of the reason for this call is not, you know, they think that they're going to, you know, get Israel to kind of relent within its own borders, but they're trying to get Israel to say we have borders, because in the legislation it says Israel is not expanding legitimately throughout the West Bank. That is illegitimate expansion. Those settlements are illegitimate. It's trying to get Israel to stop saying it all belongs to us and to say, right, there was this thing called the Green Line. And basically what this legislation does is reinstate the Green Line and tries to give international law teeth, because international law has been saying that for some years, but to no effect. Does that explain it? Yeah.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that I'm really appreciative of the exhibit and of all the people, and being a Jew myself, of the point of view of Dr. Feldman. I'm a little sad that all the people here look like me. And it just seems important to note that. I listened to Truth and Justice Radio this morning, and Cornel West was on it right over here at Harvard. And I know how hard it is to form alliances, but I think it's important to hold the space in that way. So that's what I wanted to do.
I am intrigued how the human mind works, you know, and how you can, really good human beings can, who are completely great in every area of their lives, can support tremendous injustice, even violence, killing children, and they think that they're okay with that, you know? It's just the way the human brain works. You see things in a certain context, and the context that you look at it affects how you perceive things. So I appreciate your comment about that, and I certainly can understand it. I'm looking at a room full of people, and I'm excited, you know? You know, you can look at the legislation that just passed, you know, by the U.S. Congress against boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and you could look at that and say, gosh, that's terrible. On the other hand, the fact that they're even talking about it means that it is growing so strong and so fast that they feel like there's an obligation to do something. And the vote was not unanimous. I mean, a few years ago, it would have been unanimous, and now, you know, it isn't. So there's lots of reasons for optimism.
I just say that there certainly is potential for those kinds of coalitions of folk who don't look like us for the majority. I know after Ferguson, there was a lot of concern about who had trained the police in those tactics, and you know, you could trace it back to the use of Israeli tactics, and the same with the Dakota Access Pipeline. The tactics used, those people were trained in those tactics in Israel. And so people who are affected by this here are also very potential allies.
So one of the groups I work with is called the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and it does have connections with all sorts of different groups of people across the country. It's like an umbrella organization. And what is really happening now is African American community is coming together with Palestinians, recognizing all the points of intersection, from mass incarceration to the way the police have been trained and so on. And they're strengthening ties. It's a call for justice for all people. You know, not just to say Palestinian rights, but rights for, and not just to say, you know, rights in this country, but really it's trying to rekindle what used to happen. It was called international solidarity. And I think that that is now making a comeback.
A few things. I was raised in a strict Catholic household, but my mother made sure I knew who David Ben-Gurion was and who Martin Luther King was. But I was wondering if you guys had any direct contact with either the United States government, the Palestinian government, the Israeli government, and try to, for example, when those rare occasions when the Israelis abandon a settlement, they don't just turn the keys over to the Palestinians, they tear the thing down. And that, to me, is unacceptable. And I worked at a Jewish retirement community, and it turns out that a woman I know there is the widow of someone who fought with Menachem Begin back in the 40s. So I'm 2 degrees removed from Menachem Begin, and perhaps a little more involved in this than a Catholic boy from the lily white suburbs should be, because it's something I wrestled with for a long time. And what can be done? They said, if you live in the ocean, if you live on an island, you shouldn't make an enemy of the ocean. And that's exactly what the Jews are doing in Israel right now. And the demographics don't look good for them. But what sort of a grand bargain can be made? I mean, any possibility at all of getting the Egyptians to cede some land in the Sinai and do something there and to recognize the humanity of the Palestinians? Because I don't think that's happening.
And one more thing before you go.
Yes, sir. Catch me after the meeting, and I would be honored. I think people really want peace and justice for everybody, and they'll talk about, can't we find some land for the Palestinians and stuff? And to me, that sounds like, it just doesn't resonate with me, because I think it's equivalent to saying, in South Africa, they should have made separate Bantustans for the blacks. They should have gotten a piece of another country to give the blacks some room so that there could have been two separate countries. I don't think there should be two separate states for Jewish and non-Jewish people in Israel, Palestine. If you want two states, having one state for religious Jews, religious Muslims, and religious Christians who want to cover their women and restrict what you eat, and another for the secular Jews, Christians, and Muslims. I mean, you can't tell them apart, these people. There's much more difference within the religions than there are between the religions.
Freedom, justice, and equality for all is really the call that comes out of the BDS movement. And, that can be worked out. One state, two states, three states, four states, no states. I mean, but principle has to be accepted. Everyone has to be willing to recognize the humanity of the other. And those principles, which we in the U.S. say are our values. I don't know when it comes to some countries like Saudi Arabia and Israel, how we can say, they share our values. Well, I guess Saudi Arabia, maybe not. But we constantly say Israel shares our values. But what Israel is doing most recently with its Nation State Act, which really does legitimate apartheid, it makes apartheid part of its basic law, which is the equivalent of its constitution, since it doesn't have a constitution. Privileging Jews over everyone else, even if they happen to be citizens, but because they're not Jews, they don't have the same rights as other citizens. Is this the values that Americans stand for? And so I am encouraged by the fact, when you ask, are we in touch with government? Yes. We and many of other groups around the country are constantly in touch with our representatives. And I think we are seeing signs of shifting within the Democratic Party. There are definite cracks that didn't used to be there. And one reason for those cracks is because there has been a huge shift in the Democratic base. I'm not saying all Americans, but those who support the Democratic Party, if you look at the public opinion polls, it's really quite surprising, especially among young Democrats, vast majority that Palestinians are getting a rotten deal and something has to be done about it. There's very little support for right-wing Israel. Israel, its policies as now we've seen, the Netanyahu government, implement. So I think things are shifting. Just to take one person, to see how Bernie Sanders himself has shifted. The more people know, the more push there is from the bottom, the more our elected representatives are going to start to move. And the fact that we now have 2 open supporters of BDS in Congress is really quite remarkable. So I think, we're headed somewhere. We just really can't lose patience. It's a long haul.
Unfortunately, we have to end it there. You have been listening to a forum held on February 3rd at the Friends Meeting House in Cambridge, Massachusetts, featuring Max Carter, Nancy Murray, and Stephen Feldman, creator of the Promised Land exhibit. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.